sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Facebook hits $38 a share. Unemployment rate, 7.4%, and bond yields are on the rise. We have a great guest today, Matt Galgani, who is the author of a great book that is How to Make Money in Stocks related, and also the host, co-host of IBD's weekend radio show. All this and much more on episode number 324 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So glad you could join me. Man, it's getting hot out there. I spent a little time this weekend with my son. He was, he was flying these model planes. They're very cool. There's a whole bunch of different ones. And if you've ever seen them, there's some little ones, there's big ones. They have these jets that are there. Real jets that are incredibly loud and incredibly fast. About 180 miles an hour they go. These little model planes. And they cost like $20,000 or so. So as we're flying and he's doing his thing up there and, you know, this jet is just buzzing by and all these other planes, he says, "Hey, Dad, you want to fly?" I'm like, "All right, yeah, I've never done it before, so what the heck, right?" So I'm flying around, and I'm there's two little buttons up and down, the acceleration and all this stuff. Well, give you the punchline, I crashed hard. We had to go. I tried everything to stay that thing staying up. I don't know what I did wrong, but the good news was that because it's a hobby and you have to rebuild it and all that, I spent some time with him rebuilding it. And I felt terrible, though. Absolutely terrible. We rebuilt it, and he was able to fly it. And then on the second flight that he had, because of some of the damage, the engine just evacuated. It exploded. It did something. And it just fell out of the plane. The plane came right down. Although he landed that pretty well. So we're in for another engine. But we'll see. Anyway, let's talk about some of the things that are going on. We have all sorts of interesting topics to discuss and a great guest today as well. Facebook is above $38 or right at $38 per share. I think it pinned 38 last week. And, on the DH Unplugged podcast that we do on Tuesdays, Wednesdays with John Dvorak, talked about the whole idea of Facebook and what do you do with this thing. You know, is the number that they put out a couple of weeks back really good enough for a 35% rise and all the way back to their original IPO number, or how do you play this? And this is a whole discussion of market psychology, because what you have right now is this magical number. It's $38 a share that everybody piled in with on the original IPO number, and then some people bought and it went up higher than that and then came way down. So now what you have is a line of resistance clearly at $38, because you are looking at a number that all these people that were out there that had it at $38 and it went down to 20 and 21 and 17 and then 19 and started creeping up again and then moving down are saying, "Hey, if it ever gets back to 38, I'm dumping this thing." That's a psychology. If I ever get back to even, I'm just going to move on. Now, that's not everybody, but that's a good amount of people that are out there that were buying it for the big bang, the big pop, and ended up just holding on to it for some time. And now what we have is this line of resistance. So how do you play that? Well, I'm not sure you want to really play this short Facebook. It's pretty volatile right now. It's, become a more liked stock versus the worst hated stock in the universe about a year ago. And what you do now is you watch for it to settle in at this $38 level, possibly come down a bit from here or thereabouts in this range, and watch where it goes, because once it breaks convincingly above not only the IPO level, but the high level, which is the last person that got in at the highest level that Facebook ever traded, that's when the stock can really move. We've seen this before in many IPOs. Sometimes it takes a short period of time, sometimes a longer period of time. But when you have an IPO that does see a drop in price over time and pretty quickly from the IPO date, if you wait till after the time flushes out, if there is a time, that there is a flushing of all the weaker hands and all of the people that are just holding on to break even, the opportunity really erupts into a significant upside potential. So that's just an idea. Now you may say, well, why didn't I get it then at 18 if it dropped all the way down? Well, at that time, there was still a lot of controversy about the stock, and there was some question about their viability as a revenue producer over time because of the mobile aspect of, or the lack of the mobile aspect of revenue production. And when you look at the overall, you know, scheme of the sentiment on the stock, you could say as a value player, hey, you know what? This is something that's going to eventually be good. You know, I can't go too much wrong at 16, 17, 18, 20, 22. But, you know, if you did, in fact, invest there, hey, congratulations, that's great. But if you didn't invest there, or if you did even have a small piece there, again, watch for this break above the IPO and the all-time high intraday to see where the stock potentially can move from there. That's a general game plan for IPOs. But you have to look at the chart individually, of course, but that's a good game plan concept for IPOs after the IPO has gone through. Now, the unemployment rate last Friday came out at 7.4%. There was less jobs put on than expected, and the expectations may be a little bit high after last month's and the ADP number this month. By the way, I'm starting to think that there's way too much information that we're getting lately. It seems that, you know, now we have the ADP number that everybody looks at, and they try to do a read-through, and then we have the subcomponents of the manufacturing index and the employment numbers there, and they try to do a read-through, and then, you know, it goes on, and that's a real problem. In the quote-unquote old days, you got some core information. You didn't have the Fed and the central banker speaking on a regular basis, almost incessantly, on a daily basis sometimes. You didn't have the speculation continually by various economists coming out over and over again about predictions. It was a much, I'll say, simpler time in terms of markets. That doesn't mean anything more than that, but it seems also that there's too much information that is being passed around and acted upon, and maybe because of the high-frequency trading and the algorithms that are out there, it's giving a somewhat disadvantage for the average, you know, trader, so to speak. Now, if you're a buy-and-hold kind of investor, well, you've been rewarded very nicely due to the fact that not only did you come out of the bottoms pretty well from this, but at the same time, you also had added push by the central banks constantly flushing in money into the markets and creating a situation where the VIX is down by, you know, 12.5, which is really low for what we have right now. Because we still have a uncertainty about China and what their growth is going to be, even though this weekend they came out with a slightly better service index number, but the last several manufacturing numbers and GDP and all that has been rotten to the core. Europe is supposedly going to come out of the recession, but they haven't come out yet, and that's still a problem. You have inflation around the world that's significant. And let's not even discuss the recent terrorism and evacuations of various embassies around the world. I mean, and in the economic front, the jobs number really isn't that great. And one of the things that really is probably one of the most concerning, I'll tell you, and some players are now even verbalizing that it doesn't matter. But GDP came in at 1.7% for this quarter. Now, what's interesting about that is that they guided down, or they I should say revised down, last period's GDP to 1%, about a 60% or 70% reduction from where they were. But yet this one is better, well, it's not better, but it's better than was expected. What I find very interesting and more concerning is that these revisions are so significant. We didn't go from 1.7 to 1.4, 1.5. We went down all the way to 1%. And that is a massive move in terms of dollars. About $150 billion worth of, you know, GDP that wasn't actually realized. So maybe it's just the way it is, and maybe it's something a little bit more. I'll leave it to your own speculation and your own derivation of what you believe is happening, whether or not this is move it over from this quarter to that quarter, and nobody cares about the last quarter, so, you know, you could move that down and revise it down and bump up this quarter's. I don't know if that's happening, but there's just something a little bit strange about how there's so much excitement and disregard at the same time for a particular number and the historical numbers. But yet, at the same time, we did see bond prices start to again move down, and sellers were really coming in pretty strong during the week, and yields were moving up. Now, there was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was, you know, Wall Street Journal, that talked about how if you look at the unemployment rate, the 7.4% that's being presented is really a little bit aggressive. Because if you really put in all the different factors and focus in on some of the things like the part-time jobs and, you know, the various different calculation methodologies that they use in seasonality, it's really about 7.9%. But yet, the good news for all of us on the long side is that 7.4% is splashed all over the papers and the media, and everybody's all excited about it. But, you know, you have to play with the cards that you were dealt. I'm pretty surprised, actually, the rally has extended this long. In fact, let's talk a little bit about some of the earnings that have come out recently. About 75% of the S&P 500, excluding the financials, have actually reported so far. Now, here's the quick rundown. In terms of surprises, surprises to the upside were about 55% in terms of sales revenues. But the actual number, the net number overall, was a surprise on the downside. So when you look at the amount of surprises versus the number of surprises versus the number of surprises to the downside, upside versus downside, you know, it's about higher to the upside. But the actual numbers, the actual, you know, total revenues that were brought in were actually lower than expectations. So the surprise to the downside were a lot larger. Now, in terms of earnings, there was about a 72% beat rate in terms of just, you know, the number of companies and how many beat versus how many didn't. But the actual average beat was 1%. And when you look back historically over the last several quarters, over the last several years, and you compare the various quarterly surprises to this quarterly surprise, which isn't finished yet, of course, this is probably one of the lowest quarterly surprises on revenue. Well, the last quarter was pretty ugly, but clearly on earnings, the surprise a year ago in the same quarter 1 year ago was about 2.5%, and before that was about 2.5%, and then before that was about 4%. Now, when you look at the trend over the last several quarters, when you look at, you know, quarter 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera, and you look at this is quarter 2, and you look at where it was last quarter, we were 4% last quarter upside surprise. That's significant. So while we're seeing that there's definitely been surprises in the consumer discretionary area, probably some of the best, and healthcare definitely number one in terms of overall surprises, you're seeing some ugliness in things like the energy and materials area, telecommunication services, and revenues clearly declining in the consumer staple area, and that probably has a lot to do with the headwinds that we've been talking about in terms of the high value of the dollar, or where it was at least, compared to other currencies, and how many of these consumer staples companies do business all over the world, and it really did hurt their revenues a bit. So they had to make up for it in other ways, whether it was you know, specials and why revenues were down, or maybe even some expense reduction, you know, whatever it may have been. So the overall earnings picture is really not so rosy, even though, yes, earnings are better. And yes, earnings are on the rise in general, but the expectations of what earnings are compared to the surprise doesn't seem to warrant the actual movement that we've seen lately on a stock index basis. Now, individual stocks, okay, fine. There's definitely some out there that have done quite well and deserve to have a major move in either direction. But at the same time, when you look at the overall and you take the composite, the, you know, the total mass of all of it, you have to question what the excitement really is about these markets right now, except for the fact that, you know, Bernanke backed away, stepped away, retracted his comments about the tapering. So that's kind of some of the summation of that. Let's talk about the economics coming up, and I want to talk about, after we talk to our guest, I have a listener question that I want to get to. Also, I want to talk about the relative rotation that we're seeing right now in terms of sectors, and I find it very interesting what's going on there. I'll also mention to you that Barron's had a number of comments out this weekend. One of them was on Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, and I thought this was interesting. But we're short Green Mountain Coffee Roasters for our clients. And, you know, it's kind of not gone really anywhere to speak of. Nothing major, no major moves yet. Earnings is coming up, though. And I did some research on this. And historically, Green Mountain has been able to surpass analyst estimates by about 20%. They've had some 40% numbers, like last quarter it was blowout, stock moved pretty heavily. They've had some numbers where they came right on and the stock gets just absolutely trashed. This is a classical growth stock where you need to see momentum in the earnings. And now there's a lot of competition out there. A lot of players in this market, whether it's Starbucks that's partnering with them or other players that are coming out with similar types of the K-Cups and all of this. Now, they're talking about a 20% drop in the share price for Green Mountain. Now, I'll tell you what you have to look for here. So when the earnings come out on the 7th, you need to look for the expectations of about 76 cents. You need to be looking for about an 85-cent number to see this stock stabilize where it is now. So when you see that they beat, and you know the first thing that will happen if they do beat is the stock will move up, then you have to look in a little bit further on how much do they beat on their EPS. So I'm saying that if we see a number north of, I'll go so far as 90 cents for the quarter, without any additional guidance moves and raises and annual their guidance raising there or anything else changing, we need about 85 to 90 cents for the stock to be stable or move higher. Anything lower than that should be a signal that the company really is mispriced right now, and you know, according to at least historical standards, and this could be a downside move coming for this stock. So we'll kind of watch that, kind of wait to see what happens with that, and we will hopefully report back on that as well. So let's kind of get to our guest. Let's then get back to some of the economic things that we need to be looking at and the earnings picture for the week in terms of some of the highlights that are going to go on, and listen to questions and a few other goodies. As I mentioned last week, we have Matt Galgani with us today. He is the co-host of IBD's radio show, and he's also an author of a great book that came out that I think you'll enjoy. It's How to Make Money in Stocks, Getting Started. And it's, you know, in the series, and we had Amy Smith on several times, Scott O'Neill, of course. But the whole idea of utilizing this concept of fundamental and technical analysis in order to, you know, really kind of get a portfolio going. And this book in particular, though, it kind of, I think, Matt, would I be right saying that it's a much more kind of like, okay, I don't want to say entry level, that sounds terrible, but it's much more of the beginner's guide in case you don't know some of the things, and it's really just the how to begin this process.
That's right. I look at it as a nuts and bolts book that shows you exactly how to do it. So we talk about IBD's CAN/SLIM system, give an overview of that, and then lay out a workable, actionable game plan, and then give you buying and selling checklists and routines so that you can actually implement that game plan.
Right. And one of the big things that, you know, for those of you that are fans of IBD and, or not really IBD, let's talk about the CAN/SLIM system, which is a process, but more importantly, the overall process. One of the things that IBD really, I think, puts really front and foremost is having a process, having a discipline, having a plan of action. For example, you know, the word watch lists. You know, how many times out there are people, you know, they like a stock and all that, and then, you know, a couple months later, they look like, man, what, I was going to buy that stock, you know,
yep.
or they don't like the stock and it went down, whatever it was. But, you know, you have to have these watch lists. So, I mean, tell me a little bit, this is maybe off the subject a bit, but how would you suggest people create watch lists? What do they do?
Well, first of all, you have to know what you're looking for.
Right.
And like you said, you have to have a system. So, you know, there are multiple systems, a lot of different systems you can use, but you really need to find one that works for you and start sticking to it and applying it. So when we're looking for stocks to put on our watch list, we look for stocks that have the same traits that stocks over the last 130 years, the best stocks during that time frame, typically have just before they make a big move. We're all about history, not hunches. So the CAN/SLIM system that we've been referring to is basically seven basic traits that we look for. And it, like you said, it has to do both with fundamentals, earnings, and sales, as well as some technical action in terms of institutions buying into it and pushing the stock higher. So when we're building a watch list, we're looking for stocks that have those traits. And things in IBD, like the IBD 50, Stock Spotlight, Sector Leaders, all of our lists are geared towards highlighting stocks that do have those traits right now and are ones that you want to put on your watch list. So if they do break out, you're there and ready to get them.
So now one of the things that's interesting is that I have struggled with one component of this. You know, some of the things are like, you know, you want to find a company in a new technology that doesn't do something like the others do. You know, you can look back in history. It's easy to look back in history, right, to find those, you know, versus what's right in front of us, because we don't know really what's going to be the thing.
Sure.
Right? So historically, we look back and, you know, you can pick up, let's say, a Starbucks. I mean, nobody else makes coffee, in my opinion, as bad as they make it. So obviously, it's a good thing. I really hate their coffee, or you look at, for example, when it was its thing was, you know, a Crocs or the Apple, you know, again, a very simple example of that. So because, you know, we talk about you could have invested in Diamond Rio or S3 for the MP3 player, but you would have gone broke on it.
Right.
You know, and, you know, there was a difference and it was an evolution and all that. You have to find that new. But one of the things that's in that description that you have is institutional buying. Now, what I'm really interested in is how you discern institutional buying these days, because with all the day trading that goes on and with all of the lack of general participation in the markets, aren't you seeing a lot less volume? I know it's a relative situation, but volume is like, it's nothing lately, unless you see one of those gigantic spikes, obviously.
Yeah, well, that's always one of the issues that we're looking at to gauge both the strength of the stock and the strength of the market is the volume. We need to see big, heavy volume, which shows you that those institutional investors are getting in. But stepping back for one second about how to identify these big winners before they really take off, first and foremost, what we look for is big earnings growth.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look back at Green Mountain, Starbucks, and, you know, 3D Systems and other stocks that have something new and are taking off. The first thing you're looking for is the earnings growth.
Yep.
Because that will be a telltale sign that whatever they're doing, it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And then when those earnings are starting to pop, then of course big fund managers and others are going to show an interest in that stock, and that's when they get in and start buying heavily. And what we're really looking for is unusual volume. If a stock, say, trades typically 1 million shares a day, and then for a few days or over time it's trading 2 million shares a day, or it's significantly higher on the upside, that's a sign that these big players are buying stock and, you know, accumulating more shares. So that's what we're looking for, and you can see that in a chart. We also have ratings. We have something called the accumulation distribution rating in IBD. And all it does, it just simply tracks institutional buying over the trailing 13 weeks, so basically 3 months, which obviously corresponds with the earnings season rotation. So if the stock, for example, has an A rating, which is the best, that means there's been a lot of heavy buying by institutions over that time period.
Right, exactly. So the couple of things that, let's kind of focus on the book. You have three bedrocks of successful investing, right? So you have one of your first is you put some limits on only buy when the market is in an uptrend. Now, some of the stuff we've talked about a bit, but with Amy Smith and of course with my friend Mr. O'Neill. But tell me about these kind of core things as you see them.
Well, what I wanted to do, I wanted to take Bill's CanSlim system and try to break it down into its most basic points for people who are not familiar with it, or maybe they've been using it for a while and it hasn't quite worked out, to boil it down to its most essential parts. So I came up with this idea of three big rocks, because I like the analogy that, or the saying that you want to put the big rocks in first. You can deal with the pebbles and the details later. So the first big rock is only buy when the market is in an uptrend, and you want to take defensive action as that uptrend starts to weaken and we start to roll over into a downtrend. The second one is, we talked about this just a second ago, but you want to focus on stocks with big earnings growth and a unique product or service. And the third one is institutional investors. You want to buy stocks that they're focusing on, buy stocks that they're buying, and avoid the ones that they're heavily selling. If you keep those three things in place, that will help you both make money and protect the money that you make.
You know, I was thinking about something. This was at the beginning of the year. I was thinking, you know, there was some kind of a rotation, and we don't know exactly where the money came from, but some sovereign funds were saying, hey, we're going to be putting money in the U.S. markets, and retail investors maybe came back and all that. And one of the big things that I learned many years ago from Bill's books, and it was a great little point, or it was a big point maybe, was that when a mutual fund or money manager or institution buys a stock, they target a stock and they buy a stock, or they buy stocks, they don't do it all at once. It takes time. Because if they did it all at once, it would be just a disaster. I mean, things would be moving all over the place. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to push the price too much anyway. And so they're going to try to kind of, you know, buy in. And then when it comes in a little more, they'll buy more and, you know, over time. Now, I was thinking that it was interesting that the beginning of the year was so, you know, there was this constant flow of money into stocks. Remember that? Right? Mm-hmm. It was just a slew.
Oh, what, January 2nd and 3rd, great days.
Right.
Market took off right at the beginning of the year.
Right. And then we had this like kind of this constant bit. Like there was water on in the beginning and then they just left it on, but they slowed it down and just let it go, you know? And I was thinking, it's kind of like, where is that all that money coming from? Because it was very concentrated and very consistent. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that. And I'm talking about the beginning of the year mostly, but I guess there was a lot of, not only institutions, but there was a lot of outside money coming in too because of, you know, what was going on in Japan and all that. So that's how you could see where there's institutional accumulation happening when it was broad-based like that.
That's right, and that's why we pay so much attention to that critical relationship between price and volume. I think LinkedIn is a really good example of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. where for a couple months leading up, you know, towards the end of last year, it was basing and it was kind of just muddling along there. And then, I believe it was January 10th, it just rocketed. It was a huge gap up, huge volume that shows that some institutions are getting in. And like you said, what you said before is a very, very big point, that it takes a long time for a fund to establish its position in many cases. If you're buying a whole ton of money, you know, millions of shares, for example, in some cases, it's going to take time to do. You can't just go to your trader and say, hey, buy me 3 million shares of this. It's going to jack up the price way too quickly. They want to buy in a certain range so they come out with an average cost per share that they can live with. So they're going to buy a little bit at a time. Maybe they'll even sell a little bit to push it back down so that they can buy more shares at that price. And that's why, you know, throughout the day or throughout weeks over months, you're going to see fluctuations in price. But what you're looking for is the little story that the chart is telling you. And that's basically, are you seeing much more volume on up days than you are on down days? That's telling you the real sentiment and what the actual action is of those institutional investors. They're accumulating shares.
Right. And that's I think what you just said, there's a little tidbit inside of there that I want to pull out. And okay. You said that during the day, there's some buying that goes on, and there may even be some selling that they do. Now, if you think about that, and I want everybody to listen to this, wait a minute. These guys are buying, and then they're selling into them. So they bought, let's just say, 500,000 shares. And maybe they, you know, throughout the day, they maybe hit it for 100,000. Why? Well, to make the, you know, players look like, hey, this is the top. I'm going to get out here. They drive it down a little bit, and then they just buy back in. And you see that all day long in the market. So it's not just simply the people. It's a game. Let's just put it that way. It's a poker game. It's a confidence game in terms of how, you know, where they can get the best price. And if you can actually have the power to lower down the pricing a little bit for yourself, why not, right?
Yeah, and I think if you're a day trader, that has a lot more impact on you. At IBD, we're not day traders. We're kind of medium-term traders. Like, we're certainly not buy and hold, but we're not trying to get in and out of a stock every day. And that's, you know, if you are that kind of trader, then that kind of manipulation, that kind of buying and selling action by the big players is much more important to you.
Right.
But
exactly.
In our case, we can step back and look at it certainly on a, you know, on a daily basis, look at it on a weekly basis, and sometimes even look at the long-term monthly basis. But primarily, we're looking at the daily chart and the weekly chart to see what the general trend is. And, of course, there's that fluctuation on a daily basis. There's fluctuation on a weekly basis. But, again, if you go back and if you know what to look for, and that's what I try to get into in the book, is you're looking for, is volume generally heavier on up weeks or up days than it is on down days or down weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And is the stock finding support at key areas like a 50-day moving average? Is the trading relatively tight, or is it just kind of wide and loose and all over the place? That really tells you a lot about what those institutions are really doing, because they are that proverbial elephant in the bathtub. They're just too big to hide
right, exactly.
If you're watching what they're doing on a chart.
Well, and the other thing is that obviously if you're looking at a chart and it's a, let's say, a 1 minute chart, right, compared to a weekly chart, there's a lot more volatility potential in a 1 minute chart relatively than there is in weekly. And you don't see that smooth move because you could have a day in a week that stock moves down 5%, let's say, right? Well, if you look at the daily charts, well, that's a big move, right? If you look at the weekly chart, well, maybe it moved up by the end of the week and there's nothing going on at all. So,
yeah, there's a story. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a story about this guy who went to one of IBD's seminars years and years ago, and he had been doing great. He was a dentist, and he had been doing really well with the system. He worked all day, would come home, do his routine, set up his check or set up his watch list, and then set any buy or sell orders for the next day, go back to work, and you know, rinse and repeat. And he did really, really well. He did so well that he decided, hey, I'm going to drop my practice and just trade full time.
Uh-oh.
The problem was,
I know where this is going.
You know where I'm going, right?
Yeah, he
was staring at the screen all day long, watching those one-minute screens and watching that craziness that goes on throughout the day. And he got too caught up in the minutiae, and he started doing very badly.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a problem because there's two things that go in there. There's the fact, and I have a story that this is years ago, but there's a gent that was working and doing some studying on a few different systems, and he was using, quote-unquote, paper money, you know, paper trading. And he was making a ton of money. I mean, it was enormous. And then as soon as he went live, he lost his shirt. Now, why? Well, he didn't figure that the cost to buy would be what it is because he just popped the trade in when he thought it would be there, right? He would buy a lot of shares of small stocks. So if you have a 20-cent stock and you buy a million shares, you're probably going to move that price a little bit. Well, he didn't market that way when he was doing his training and paper trading. And then when you sell it, you're going to get knocked down a few cents too. So what happened was that he couldn't get the shares that he wanted, the volume that he wanted. And then it was a mess. It was terrible. Anyway, in terms of some of the things that we want to kind of share that have, for example, you know, we've been seeing some interesting earnings and reaction to the earnings during this earnings season, right?
Right.
You know, we've seen from the who cares with the Amazon? You know, Amazon's numbers came out and everybody focuses on the operating margins and operating earnings rather than everything else. I mean, Amazon came in with actually a textbook terrible quarter with a big but behind it, right? And then you had some other companies, like, for example, one I know that you talk about is TripAdvisor. Now, I'll just tell you a quick story. TripAdvisor, if many people haven't, if you haven't looked at this and you don't know too much about it, it's not as popular here, in my opinion, as it is in the rest of the world, which is interesting. Because if I was just in Morocco and Portugal and I've been around, the TripAdvisor sticker and sign is everywhere that they have a TripAdvisor rating. And they're really big on, you know, telling you or asking you to please leave a review there for them.
Right.
So, you know, it's a review site, but also they make money through a variety of interactions and all. Tell us a little bit about why this one is a stock that's on kind of that list of yours.
Well, it has to do with the numbers first and foremost. They've tended to post pretty decent earnings growth. Q1, they posted 32% earnings growth, and they came in with 27% in the most recent quarter. We look at a lot of different things. We talked about those seven traits that we're looking for. So for each stock, we'll look at essentially all of those traits, see how well that particular stock is doing, and then we're going to compare that to how all other stocks are doing. So you have a relative rating to look at. And one of the key ones is we call the composite rating, basically an overall rating. It goes from 1 to 99. And right now, TripAdvisor has the highest possible 99 rating. And that means, in terms of the key things that we look for, it's outperforming all other stocks, or excuse me, outperforming 99% of all other stocks. So it's right there in that top 1%. Another big thing that TripAdvisor has is return on equity. It's 43%. That is a very, very strong return on equity. We typically look for a minimum of at least 17%, so that's well over twice that size. And that's a really good mark of a well-run company that's using its capital well, and eventually that will drive better earnings growth. And earnings growth is the number one thing that we look for. It's the number one thing that institutional investors look for.
You know, the truth about TripAdvisor, as I see it, by the way, is not that it's a cheap site to run and not a cheap company to run, not by any means, okay? But they have an entire sales force out there that's actually selling for them. Because they're having, first of all, it's kind of like, in a very loose, broad measure, It's like a Facebook for travel. My wife has all, she has some kind of, I don't even know what rating she has of all these reviews she's done. And we actually look there and trust the site. You have to be a little discriminating when you look at who you're, you know, who you're reading and what the reviews are and what their ratings are. But, you know, it's a great place. I was in Costa Rica. And what I did was...
I use it all the time.
Yeah, I was on the phone.
It's great.
Give me TripAdvisor. Where do we go? What do you do? What do you see? What do you eat? You know, and the hope is that you're getting some decent things. And like I said, they've leveraged it very well. You also mentioned a... I think this is really interesting. There's a lot of these for-profit educational firms out there, and there's been a lot of news surrounding them that has not been pretty. And, you know, you go through the list of from... when the government's going to crack down, and I don't know if they have, you know, every time the government's going to crack down on something, the stocks get killed, but they never do anything about it, so they just come right back up, for the most part. Right. So there was a big crackdown on, you know, who was going to be paid and all this. There's all these Senate hearings and I haven't heard about anything in the longest time, I can tell you. And all these stocks.
A few years ago, I know there was a big scandal going on with a couple of those.
Yeah, and
but they seem to have survived.
They seem to have survived, and you know, maybe the stocks are a bit depressed, But nonetheless, tell me about why this one, for example, out of the, let's call them 10 others, let's just say, or so, why is this one such a, you know, a good example of a company that is in that, you know, kind of list?
You're talking about Grand Canyon Education?
Yep.
Yep. Well, again, we're looking for stocks that have the traits that past winners had just before they took off, and earnings was a big one. Grand Canyon has slowed down a bit recently. They were between 26% to 52% earnings growth for seven straight quarters, but in Q2, that slipped to 15%, and sales also dropped. Still fairly good at 19%. That growth is still decent, but it's been slowing a little bit. So that's a little worrisome there. But again, like I said about TripAdvisor, one of the key things we look at is return on equity, and Grand Canyon's is solid. It's 36%, so it's more than double that 17% minimum that we look for. If you look at its three-year EPS growth rate, it's 70%. That's obviously very, very strong. The group, we also look at stocks as groups, and we divide the whole market into 197 different industry groups, and that particular industry group right now is doing quite well. But that said, when Grand Canyon released its earnings, it sold off pretty sharply and volume was extremely strong. Now, it did find support at its 50-day line, so it's a question now of what happens next.
Yeah, and that 50-day line is often a place that institutional investors look, and it's as arbitrary as you can get, by the way. I've always said that. You know, and why can't you have a 55-day line? I don't know, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but the only reason it matters is that the big players use it.
Right, they use it for whatever really reason, and they use it, by the way, because the other guys use it. It's kind of one of the accepted things that are out there. There's a couple of other stocks on here. You know, one of the ones, I'm looking at this whole list that you kind of sent me over and all, you know, in the book, you talk a little bit about how to handle the earnings, and earnings obviously can move a stock all over the place, you know, and sometimes you see a headline that they beat by blah, 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 and the stock's down 10%. Sometimes you see that they've missed by blah, blah, and they're up, you know, 20%, because it's not only the earnings necessarily, it's also the outlook, it's also what the expectations. Let's be frank. Let's get it on the table. The fact of the matter is that the earnings game is all about the fact that everybody knows, for the most part, that companies are geared because of what information they give out and all that to beat by a penny or two. That's the way I see it. You know, if you don't beat it by a penny or two, you know, something's wrong to begin with. You know, and that's why you see company after company beating by a couple of cents, but maybe revenue's down or whatever, because nobody really looks at the revenue as much. So you got to find a really good beat. And then the outlook is just as important moving forward, which is a little bit harder to, you know, to understand because oftentimes it's ranges. But how do you handle earnings? What do you do with that?
Well, I think you've said it very well right there. Earnings is basically a crapshoot. You don't know how the company is going to report, and you don't know how the market is going to react. And that's why one of our main things to do during earnings season is, first and foremost, know when a stock that you own or have on your watch list is scheduled to report so that you're not caught surprised, that you can have a game plan in place ahead of time. If it does this, I'm going to buy or I'm going to sell. If it does that, then I'll take the opposite action. So have a game plan so you're not just sitting there wringing your hands wondering what to do when it does report and the market reacts. The second thing is, as a general rule, it's best not to buy a stock just before it reports because you don't know how it's going to play out. You're better off waiting to see how it reports and how the market reacts, and if it reports well and the market reacts well and it's near what we're calling a potential buying opportunity, that's when you want to buy it. So you're really not giving up a lot of upside, but you are dramatically reducing your potential downside.
But if you don't want to buy a stock right before earnings, right? So let's just say that earnings is, you know, the first of the month, let's just say, okay? And you don't want to buy it, let's say, on the, I don't know, 20th of the month or whatever the date is that maybe give you some running space here. But if you hold it already, you're kind of in the same boat. And you may have held it for a while and have no gain or loss.
Yeah, you have to have a plan for that as well. And I think there's no magic answer, unfortunately, to, you know, whether you should hold or not. But you can ask a few questions. One would be, how is the overall market doing? Is it looking strong or is it starting to weaken? In general, how is that particular stock doing in terms of its chart action? Is it holding up relatively well, or is it starting to maybe sell off a little bit harder on the downside? You can look at these different things to give yourself an idea of whether you want to hold or not. Another big thing is, what kind of gain are you sitting on? If you're sitting on a huge gain, you have a much bigger cushion. If you bought this thing very recently and you're just at break even or maybe on a slight gain, well, then you have to approach that differently. And it's kind of up to your own risk tolerance, but whether you sell before or not. But at a minimum, have a plan in place to cut your losses at a level you can live with if it doesn't report well and it does sell off.
You know, I kind of take a little bit of the other side of that for a moment. And, you know, I don't think it really matters whether you have a gain or loss in it, because it's what your intent is on the stock to begin with. Because if you have a big gain on it, you may want to take some of the profit out. You know, even though you have a cushion, you know, it's not like it's, you could say, okay, I'm playing with the house money at this point. But, you know, I mean, it's your money. It's your value. It's what it is. So, I mean, I think that, yeah, it's whatever the game plan is should hold. But I do agree that, you know, taking a position, you know, at 359 before, you know, it could be well. You could do well because you have an idea of what you think is going to happen. You take a small position. If it doesn't work out, fine. If it works out, you add to it.
And it's not an all or nothing proposition. If you do have a big gain in a stock that's about to report, you can always sell a portion of your holdings.
Right.
And you lock in those profits, but then if there's upside, you can still benefit from that. But if there's a huge downward gap, you're not taking as much of a hit, and you've already locked in some nice profits.
Exactly. And so, you know, the other thing is that in the book, I kind of marked some pages up. You talk about some other stocks. You know, I've noticed that a lot of the healthcare, biotech, that whole genre has been doing really well. Now, you know, some of the things you can say, there's been a lot of possible, you know, things that are in the air that could be problematic for them. On the other hand, you could say, well, we have an aging population here and around the world, by the way, and, you know, it may be really good for them. You know, one of the companies that you have on this is something that we actually own as well, and we talked about, is Questcor. They're a we'll call it a biotechnology company. A pharmaceutical company. They don't have many products, by the way, and they've had a lot of short sellers coming after them a lot. But yet, at the same time, they reported earnings a few days ago, and the stock went up like, I don't know, 25% or something like that. This stock has a habit of doing that, and, you know, going up for a few days and kind of pulling back a little bit. You get some weird news out from these short selling guys. But, you know, with a company like that only really has one or very few products, do you have to look at that differently?
I think you have to be definitely aware of that, because, like you said, if there's bad news on that particular product, you might take a hit. So it could be a little bit more speculative than others. If you look at that chart again, that's a crazy chart over the last, you know, year and a half or so. But now it is doing very well. Again, earnings is really the most important. And when it reported recently, it went from 25% earnings growth to 96% earnings growth.
Mm-hmm.
And sales went from 41% to 64%.
Right.
So that's a promising thing, and that's what investors like to see, and that's why it made that huge gap up, made a huge gain on that. Whether that holds or not, we'll have to see. But that's, you know, that's part of really when you're buying a stock, you want to be picky and see if all of the pieces are in place. Whether, you know, it's the uptrend, it's the earnings. And then again, look at the chart. This is a fairly volatile stock, so I don't think I'd bet the farm on Questcor.
Right.
But, you know, it's something where you can put some amount of money into it, but like with any other stock, you have to have a game plan for what kind of profits are you looking for, when are some potential sell signals going to be hit, whether it's taking your profits or if it's not working for you, cutting your losses.
And I'll just add one more thing. One of the things I look at also, which is really not very much talked about on the IBD side, is the short interest. Because most people that are just thinking, oh my God, look at all the people that are short on that stock, are thinking, mm-hmm. that must be a terrible stock. It may be the worst stock in the world. But the fact of the matter is, if they surprise anywhere to the upside, those shorts cover and it really rockets the stock.
Yeah, it's something that you want to pay some attention to, but this is really kind of the bottom line, I think, for the stock market in general. There are a million different indicators that you can look at. And it's very easy to be the deer in the headlights with this screen that's got every single button flashing and giving you all these different indicators. But at the end of the day, the most important thing to watch is the price and volume action in the stock itself.
Yep.
And if you're seeing this stock continue to move up, volume is continually strong, and it's finding support at key benchmarks, that tells you that somebody's buying that stock and pushing
absolutely.
It up, and there's not a lot of sellers in there.
I hear you. Matt Galgani, who, of course, you can listen to the radio show each and every weekend on this. It's on iTunes. You can go right to the investors.com website. And also make sure to go get this book, because I think that there's a lot in there for you to learn from it. It's Making Money, How to Make Money in Stocks, Getting Started. And it's out in bookstores and Amazon and all over the place. So I really encourage you. We'll put all the information, of course, on the show notes for this podcast and have it available for you. Matt, hey, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
All right, see ya. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Good stuff. Really good stuff from Matt. I like him a lot. I think he has a really good way of presenting things. And actually, because of the fact that this book is really a good beginner's guide and more for, you know, a little bit above that. So if you know something about investing, it's not like you shouldn't read this book. But this is definitely a guide. And if you haven't read any of the How to Make Money in Stocks books, going back with William O'Neill and his original, or some of the ones that have been updated, or the derivatives like has been written by Matt here, I really encourage you to do so. When people write me and they say, hey, what's a great book to read? There's a few of them out there in terms of really understanding the fundamentals of investing, but this is one of the classics, and this whole How to Make Money in Stocks idea and concept is really great. So I really encourage you to do that. Let's talk about listen to a question that came in from Patrick, and he says, I don't think we covered this. This is something I've been staring at for a while and thinking about. He says, I've been playing around with the high volatility after hours, after an earnings announcement comes out, and I'm wondering if you can kind of shed some light on something. And he gave me a chart to look at, and he was wondering what can cause the big jumps. He says he thinks he's called wicks in a candle chart at the arrows pointing. So, yeah, I'm telling you, he's correct about that. The long stems that come on a candle chart, when you're looking at them, those very thin lines from the middle that extend down or extend up are called wicks. So he says he initiated his trades in between the second and third wicks, and I have a limit order to sell way below where they jump up to. So why would anybody buy this stock at such a big price when they're just totally in the sky? I know that there are offers to sell for much lower than that since my order didn't trigger. Thanks a lot. Okay, so here's a couple things, Patrick. First of all, you have to look at what system you're using. So I don't know what platform you're looking at, or maybe a website. But when you look at the wicks and you look at the price range for that period, whether it's daily or 1 minute or 30 minutes, you have to know whether or not you're getting price information for trade or for bid and ask. So, for example, let's say that in the after hours of stock, and let's just say it's not even trading on any news, let's say that it closed at $50. And let's say that after the close, the bid goes down to 47 and the ask goes to 55. That's the range. That's the spread. Now, that doesn't mean that anybody actually bought that at that price because it's just the bids. And some systems will show you bid and ask prices without trades. So you want to see the actual trades and make sure that your system is set up to see actual trades only, or else you're going to get some wild numbers out there. So therefore, that could be one thing that's going on. The second thing is that you can have a situation where, again, everybody pulled their trades, and there could have been some limit orders put in there because there were some stops put on a short, or there were stops put on a long, and those hit at those levels because they become market orders once they hit at that level. So even in the after hours. Now, usually in the after hours, you can only place limit orders or stop limit orders. But still, if you have it at that level and it does hit that level, and for whatever reason that the you know, let's say you were the bidder and the stock came way down to your price, well, you're going to hit it. And you probably just blew out somebody's stop that was there versus active trading going on there. And that's where you see the jumps. See that big range. You see that movement from, you know, that number we talked about before, all the way down at 45, let's say, somebody hits it, and all of a sudden it goes to 48. It's not because there was anybody really actively involved in this, because that's where the bids laid out. Somebody came in after the fact and bid it there, and you still don't know if somebody's going to be actually trading it there. So I think that may be a big cause of the situation, and obviously you have to be very careful and deal with liquid stocks as best as possible in the after hours, and especially with earnings, because oftentimes the liquidity is just so ridiculously light that you can get hit at some really bad numbers. On the other hand, you could be the guy doing the hitting. So if you do the things that you're mentioning where you're really trying to bid down or short way up high, and you're lucky enough that a stop is blown and you get those positions at those prices, hey, that's a great thing. So there is some opportunity there, but again, you can't do it with lots of shares because there's usually not a whole lot of liquidity in those time periods. Now, I mentioned some eco that's coming out that I think you need to be aware of. The ISM non-manufacturing composites coming in, expected to be about 53. This is the service index. And we did see the manufacturing number come in last week at 55, which I was pretty surprised about because, we've seen the slowdown in manufacturing, slowdown in manufacturing hiring, slowdown in the regional numbers, yet somehow, miraculously, we got this 55 number, which was much higher than anticipated by analysts and economists and me, for that matter. And I was very surprised that it really did jump up that high. It was pretty amazing. Now, the service index has been one of those that has been really holding tight for some time. It really is important in the U.S. because so much of our economy is based on that. And we'll look at this, and this is really going to be dealing with, you'll see things like the restaurants and a variety of other industries really be moved by this number if it comes in hot or not. We're also going to see, there's not a lot going on next week. We're going to see mortgage applications on the 7th, initial jobless claims, and then wholesale inventories. Really a light week overall, some mortgage delinquency numbers coming in, trade balance, but really not a not a substantial week for economics, because last week was so chock full of it. I mean, it was just a daily onslaught of eco numbers throughout the week, and the big daddy, of course, on Friday, which was the employment numbers that we saw. So it's going to be a light week for that, which is good. You know, those kind of situations are often, you see more volatility in markets in terms of when other news comes to play. Because usually the volatility you'll see in the markets on eco numbers are, somewhat surrounding the economic number in that time period. But, and same thing with earnings. When you see earnings, it's surrounding that, the big move is really during that time, an hour or so when earnings comes out, and then the next day or into the regular market session. But you will see also at the same time a significant amount of movement, and I'm sure there'll be other news that does pop up. One of the big things that I'm looking at is I'm still concerned about the ridiculous price of oil. Now, oil may have popped up again last week due to the fact that there was this terrorist scare and this whole issue with the evacuation of the embassies throughout many of the countries in the Middle East, and therefore the oil traders always get all excited about that. You know, I think oil prices are going to be going higher. But we did see an abominable number last week in terms of the inventory numbers, just an absolute incredible differential between what was expected to be drawn and actually what was the build on the inventories. So there's no shortage of oil here, gang. There's none at all. But the oil traders still have this thing, pushing this 105 number, and you just got to wonder when this, you know, the bow breaks on this deal, because the speculation is so high with it. At the same time, you're seeing them go back to dumping gold again. You see that move on Friday? Wow, that was a big move. I mean, you know, things were kind of going well, and wham. I still do like to work the gold miners. The volatility there has been really interesting. You can look at GDX or NUGT or DUST. The last two are a synthetic version of it, which has a triple effect, negative and positive. And the other one is the gold miners. And there's a GDXJ, which is the junior gold miners. They're much more volatile, and they can have a lot more movement. But, you know, if gold does break again, you know, you may see a lot of people really trailing out of this, because it was seeing significant selling pressure for some time. And you do have now, again, a lot of people have piled on looking for a rebound, and those will be the first out, and that can create a significant avalanche of selling. So we'll see what happens with that. Next week, we have Frank Curzio coming on the show. I haven't talked to him with you for a long time. I'm going to bring him back. We're going to talk about his stuff. You might remember he talked about how small caps are going to be strong, and they're ridiculously strong these days. But you will want to watch for that. And, of course, I want to mention to you, you have to start watching the videos that we put out on a regular basis. We're putting them out on a variety of different stocks and setup opportunities that we're looking at. And these are kind of the pre versions of what could erupt into an actual alert for Trigger Point Research equity alerts. And these are what is setting up some of the charting fundamentals in terms of price and volume action. And it really gives you a decent insight into this. About 5 minute long, and you can find those on TriggerPointResearch.com. You'll see it on our site or over on YouTube, YouTube.com/TriggerPointResearch. Otherwise, thanks for joining me. We'll see you next week. And of course, if you're looking for a money manager, we have a variety of different strategies here that you can check out. Just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you'll see a little blue box there. Click on it, put your information in. You'll see a 12-minute virtual tour of it, and you can find out a lot more information about what is going on here, if you like what we said, or if you didn't like what we said. Either way, I did enjoy our show today, and I look forward every week to seeing you. Have a great week and a profitable one. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.